Good morning, everyone. Our first case for the day is 062457, Coulter, Dwayne Coulter versus Deirdre Battaglia. Mr. Feinerman, go ahead.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm Gary Feinerman from the Office of the Illinois Attorney General, here on behalf of respondent appellant Terry McGann. The district court's judgment granting habeas relief should be reversed. The district court rested its decision on two procedural grounds. It held that the state trial court, Judge McSweeney Moore, contrary to this court's mandate in Coulter versus Gilmore, one, failed to supplement the record with additional evidence and instead relied solely on the transcripts from the 1987 voir dire and the 1991 Batson remand hearing from the state appellate court, and two, failed in its oral ruling to list and review on the record the reasons for the peremptory strikes pertaining to each excused African-American veneer person at issue. Those grounds are incorrect, as I'll explain in a moment. If this court agrees with me on that, it has two options, among others. It could vacate the district court's order and remand for consideration of the substantive question of whether Judge McSweeney Moore's ruling erred in finding that there was no intentional racial discrimination. In other words, whether Judge McSweeney Moore clearly erred in finding no intentional discrimination at the third stage Batson hearing, or it could resolve that substantive question itself. And in the event the court agrees with me on the procedural grounds and wants to reach the substantive question itself, we've briefed that and I'm prepared to argue the substantive question today. Turning to the grounds for the district court's decision.
Mr. Feinerman, I just wanted to maybe help you a little bit by saying I didn't have any problem with your argument, at least myself, that there was nothing in this court's prior decision that either said more evidence had to be taken or more evidence didn't have to be taken or anything else. It seemed to me what we were saying to the state courts was that, as a matter of comedy, we wanted to allow the state courts the opportunity to evaluate the Batson question on the proper legal standards, and it was a focus on legal standards. So at least as to that issue, I don't know how my colleagues feel, but from my own point of view, I'm more interested in the second of your two points and in the question whether maybe you're not giving the district court judge here quite enough credit. I thought that in the end she was saying, if that's all you have to say, then I have to assume you didn't find any problems. And that itself is the difficult. She has to assume that the state judge thought that there was no substantive Batson problem and that she took issue with.
I don't want to add to your, you know, whatever, but in response, my worry is how we can be, excuse me, confident that Judge McSweeney Moore considered whether the state's peremptory strikes that we highlighted in our last opinion was, you know, consistent with its treatment of other similarly situated members of the veneer. And see, when I read her remarks, she doesn't even say that she engaged in such an analysis, let alone put her rationale on the record, the way I read it. So
I agree with you.
Maybe globally you can help us out here.
I agree with you halfway. I think she did say that she engaged in the comparative juror analysis.
Sure. She says it. She says it. But
what she
saying it and doing it are just so different.
She said that she did, and she said that she concluded that, taking into account the totality of the circumstances, and she said comparing and contrasting the stricken veneer persons with the white veneer persons who were seated as jurors, she found that there was no discrimination.
But why doesn't she engage in the analysis? Why doesn't she say, this is why, that is why?
She did engage in the analysis, but she did not put her precise thoughts on the record. She didn't say, well, with respect to Melvin Igus, I find this. With respect to Melanie Pinkins, I find that, although Petitioner's counsel didn't mention Melanie Pinkins at the 1998 Batson hearing, or with respect to Marcina Adams, I find that. It certainly would have been better had Judge McSweeney Moore done that. In fact, had she done that, I might be at Ms. Salinger's table and Ms. Salinger might be at mine. But the question isn't whether Judge McSweeney Moore gets an A-plus or even a B-minus for her analysis. The question is whether she did what was required of her by this court's remand order and by governing pre-EDPA law that provided the backdrop against this entire proceeding. And pre-EDPA law is clear. Wainwright versus Witt, Perkett versus Ellum. State trial court judges don't have to go by juror by juror and explain the rationale with respect to each juror. And again, I want to be clear, it would have been better had she done that. But
well, you sound like you're agreeing with the state appellate court that said that, you know, she doesn't have to do what we request.
She did have to do what you requested, and she did do what you requested. It's just that you didn't require that she engage in an on-the-record, juror-by-juror explanation as to her final conclusion. And you could have required her to do that.
Well, but
that would not have been consistent with cases like Wainwright versus Witt, which says that state trial courts, as a general matter, don't have to do that.
Well, then if we had required her to do that, would the state appellate court have been correct that she didn't have to follow our directive?
Of course not. You gave a directive, and the state trial court had to follow that directive, and she did follow that directive and what was required of her under pre-EDPA law.
But here's my problem with that. I mean, it's a very finely tuned point that you're making, because we all agree that the Supreme Court has said that even one peremptory challenge made on the basis of impermissible racial reasons is enough to violate the constitutional rights of the defendant. And so what we're left with when there's nothing on the record is we have to assume that she went through and she looked at Pinkins and decided there was no racial bias. She looks at Igas and decides there's no racial bias. And then you have the record, and we're kind of left inferring so much. I mean, we're left not knowing why she doesn't think, in the light of some very troublesome evidence in the record, that this isn't a problem.
You're left to infer that, yes, but we have to bear in mind that at this 1998 Batson hearing, the assistant state's attorney and Mr. Coulter's counsel engaged in an extended argument that discussed each of the jurors, although, again, Coulter's lawyer didn't mention Pinkins. And what if you go down that road, what you're really saying is that the state trial judge, after saying, I compared and contrasted the stricken jurors with the seated jurors and I found no problem, and by that I mean I had no problem with respect to Igas for this reason, I had no problem with respect to Adams for that reason, and that's not what this court required, and it would have been arguably inconsistent with Wainwright versus Witt to require the trial court to do that, although you could have done it, but you didn't. I think in this situation, you take the court's statement that it did a comparison and contrast, take her word at it, and then decide under the second point that I had, the substantive Batson analysis, whether she was correct. And you have a record, you have the prosecutor's contemporaneous statements at voir dire. You could look at the record and decide for yourself whether the judge's conclusion was clearly erroneous, whether the presumption had been overcome by convincing evidence. In terms of, I've already mentioned Pinkins. I see I'm into my...
Go ahead. I'm not going to rush you through this one.
Okay, thank you. With respect to Pinkins, the state appellate court found that the petitioner had waived, or they used the word waived, but they really mean forfeited that, and that's an adequate and independent state ground that precludes Coulter from relying upon Pinkins in a federal habeas court. With respect to Marcina Adams, she had medical training. She was a licensed practical nurse. The concern was that she had medical training that might influence her consideration of the medical testimony supporting petitioner's insanity defense. It's important to note that this case wasn't a whodunit. He had He had the gun. The bullets matched. He had gunpowder residue on his arm. At some point, he said, well, I got angry at the officer, and I banged my arm on the hood of the car, and the gun fired and hit the police officer, but there was no residue on the car. Really, all that he had was an insanity defense. So,
Mr. Feinerman, does the state still have all this evidence? I mean, if there were a retrial now, 20 years later, did the state retain the physical evidence that was introduced?
I don't know that. I don't know.
It's just.
And there's the Mr. Coulter posits three comparables, two individuals whose relatives were undergoing mental health treatment, and one veneer person who had actually received that treatment. But there's a difference between undergoing training, medical training, and receiving medical treatment, just like there's a difference in your outlook on the law between going to law school and hiring an attorney. The prosecutor can reasonably think that Adams was going to approach this case in a different way, and Judge McSweeney more reasonably concluded that that was a legitimate distinction. With respect to Melvin Igus, this was a 21-year-old man living with his mother who had been unemployed for a year despite having three children by two different women.
But that's what bothered me, to ask only an African-American man whether his children are by different mothers struck me as a very racist thing to do, to be quite honest.
You know, and I will add to that, I felt the very same way, particularly in light of the fact that the Caucasian had a 7-year-old and a 7-month-old. And the possibility, you know, certainly is out there that that might have been two different mothers as well.
That's possible, although the Caucasian had been divorced, so maybe the judge thought that both children were of the marriage.
But see, judges aren't supposed to imagine. They're supposed to ask these questions, particularly if they ask the African-American man. Judge Bailey surely should have asked.
Perhaps, but then he would have run headlong into petitioner's trial counsel, who argued quite vigorously that it was, quote, unnecessary information that is not pertinent to jury selection and improper to ask anybody about paternity.
One or the other, both or none.
Well, the petitioner's trial counsel didn't make that argument, didn't say if you ask it of one, you have to ask it at all. Counsel was arguing you shouldn't ask it of anybody, and in fact moved for a mistrial on the ground that those questions were asked at all. So now petitioner has done a 180 and said at voir dire said you shouldn't ask it of anybody, and now is arguing the trial judge should have asked it of everybody. That's not a ground on which habeas relief ought to be granted.
I'm going to give you one last thought, because we do have a courtroom full of people waiting and some judges waiting as well.
Oh, so for all those reasons, including and the other factors that Judge McSweeney Moore went into, the statistics, her ascertainment of general strategy underlying the strikes, the integrity of the prosecutors, could a judge in Judge McSweeney's shoes come to a different conclusion? Perhaps.
You know, the integrity of the prosecutors is interesting, because we have the judge thinking that they're credible based on her personal knowledge of them, but her personal knowledge wasn't derived from having observed them as a judge, but, you know, from other extrajudicial experiences with them that predated her tenure on the bench. And normally we don't approve of judges basing their decisions on extrajudicial knowledge. I know you cited from, you know, some cases where some dicta was noted, but I'm not certain it was proper for her to resort to her personal impressions of the two prosecutors. Of course, you're left, you know, with, sad to say, one who is no longer alive.
Right. Yeah, the case law is quite clear that a trial judge can rely upon his or her views of the prosecutor's integrity and credibility in making a third-stage Batson decision. There's no case saying that the knowledge has to derive from a judicial context as opposed to maybe being colleagues on the bench or colleagues in a state's attorney's office.
Well, of course, how much weight we should give something like that is the question.
I think even if you take that out and rely on the other reasons given by Judge McSweeney Moore, again, maybe another judge could have reached a different decision, but the question here in this case may end up being about the standard of review, is whether Judge McSweeney Moore's conclusion was clearly erroneous, and it was not. And for that reason, we ask that the district court's judgment be reversed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Feinerman. And I will give you your rebuttal time. How much extra time did we take up just now? Okay, we'll add it, please, to Ms. Salinger's time.
Good morning, Your Honors. Deborah Salinger, Assistant Appellate Defender, here on behalf of Petitioner Dwayne Coulter. When this court remanded the case for a Batson hearing, this court was very specific that this court wanted the trial court to compare the prosecutor's strikes against African Americans with its treatment of Caucasians. Specifically, this court said in order to detect situations such as Pinkins and Adams. The same unanswered questions today still remain. The record belies Judge McSweeney Moore's conclusion that she examined the totality of the circumstances. No deference needs to be accorded that where it's not supported by the record.
No, I'm going to start off with Judge Rovner's final point with Mr. Feinerman. This case is really kind of a mess right now, I think, and we would probably all agree to that. Judge Rovner asked Mr. Feinerman about the integrity of the prosecutor and that assessment by the judge. And as I see it, these Batson cases pretty much boil down to that issue. The prosecutor gives a reason, and on its surface, these are our race-neutral reasons for exercising the strikes that were exercised. And the prosecutor's reason is either credited or not credited by the judge. Now, here, if we're supposed to look at the totality of the circumstances, to me, a very strong indicator of the intent of the prosecutor is found in the fact that the prosecutor did not exercise four available peremptory challenges to remove other African Americans, and there were three African Americans ultimately sat on the jury. So if we're looking at the totality of the circumstances here, and the most important ingredient, at least as I see it, maybe you will disagree with that, but as I see it, the most important ingredient in that is the judge's assessment of the credibility, integrity of the prosecutor in stating why he or she took the action that he or she took. So if that's the situation here, and we're viewing the totality of the circumstances, and this is collateral review in a habeas case that's 20 years old and people are gone, where do we go from here?
Your Honor, I believe you're absolutely correct that the judge views the demeanor of the prosecutor, and based on integrity and based on what the judge views as far as those explanations, the judge can make a determination whether the reasons are pretextual or not pretextual. What's different here is Judge McSweeney Moore was not the trial judge. She had no opportunity to view the demeanor or the credibility of the prosecutors during the actual trial while they were exercising those challenges. The only Judge Bailey had a Batson hearing. It was remanded by the Illinois Appellate Court in 1991, but made no additional findings at that point. Judge Bailey would have been the judge to assess the credibility of the prosecutors. That, in this case, Your Honor mentioned those four unused challenges. At that point, defendant had moved for made Batson motions at least three times. In Miller L. versus Drecke, the court points out that just because there are some African Americans who wind up on the jury, it just means that the motive of the prosecution has now been exposed and they're maybe exercising some prudent restraint in now not excluding all African Americans from the jury. Initially, the state used 6 out of 6 challenges to exclude African Americans, and then ultimately 9 out of 10. In Miller L. versus Drecke, the court, for the same 90%, 91%, said happenstance is unlikely to produce that disparity. So the fact that there were African Americans that were on the jury does not answer the question. In fact, this court has certainly recognized the exclusion of one wrongful exclusion of one African American is enough. And certainly here, there's no deference that needs to be accorded Judge McSweeney Moore's findings. There's no presumption of correctness where it's not supported by the record. And here, Miller L. versus Drecke is certainly very instructive on this issue, that based on Miller L., there was purposeful discrimination here. Looking at a comparative analysis of Pinkins and Mason.
Well, can we stop for a moment on Pinkins?
Has Pinkins been forfeited?
Yeah. No, Your Honor.
Or waived?
No, Your Honor.
That's what the Illinois Appellate Court found.
The Illinois Appellate Court found that in Coulter 2, which was vacated by the United States Supreme Court, every decision in Illinois has reached the merits, has addressed Pinkins. The last court of resort in the state has addressed Pinkins. And the only reason that Coulter filed a post-conviction petition of alleging ineffectiveness of counsel was in response to the aberrant Coulter 2 decision. But Coulter 2 has now been vacated.
And it's discussed in Coulter 3, right? Pinkins comes up in Coulter.
Absolutely, and in Coulter 5 as well. And
that just shows what a mess this case
is. It does. It absolutely
Coulter
does.
Coulter 5 and Coulter 3.
We're going to have to get into
Go ahead.
Additionally, Coulter filed a motion before this court to, I can't remember the year, I want to say 2003, to file a successive petition, and this court ruled it was just a continuation of
2002,
of the prior habeas petition. There's certainly no default, no waiver as to Pinkins. And if you look at Pinkins and Mason, they are identically situated. At Batson, in Miller L. versus Drecke, they say that Batson would be rendered inoperable if you required identically situated veneer people to compare them. But I can't imagine a situation where two jurors are more identically situated. That Mason was questioned first, and Mason, among other things, said that his daughter worked at Tinley Park Hospital, and the state accepted Mason, a Caucasian juror. Then comes along, subsequently, Melanie Pinkins, an African-American woman, and she says that her mother works at Mercy Hospital, and the state excuses Melanie Pinkins, and the explanation is because her immediate relative, her mother, worked at the same hospital as a defense witness, Dr. Hemrick. The identical reason was true for Mason.
But what are we to do with the fact that now seems to have come out that Ms. Pinkins lived with her mother and Mr. Mason maybe didn't live with his daughter? I mean, there are some differences.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and the court has said that even though an appellate court, those differences came out in Coulter 5, and even though an appellate court could imagine some reasons, could theorize on some plausible explanations, they need to have been the ones advanced by trial counsel at the time of voir dire. And here, Judge Bailey was emphatic that he wanted every reason on the record. And here, living with her mother, whether Mason discussed the work with his daughter, Those were not said. Additionally, when it comes to Adams, if the state was so concerned about her medical training and this was an insanity defense and maybe she would understand a psychiatric defense, then they should have asked the court to ask supplemental questions of the other members of the veneer. It should have, if it was really a truthful, credible explanation, that a concern of theirs, then they should have asked the other members of the veneer whether they had taken majored in psychology in college or taken psych courses, if that was truly a legitimate question. Again, with Egas, they relied on the fact that Egas had children of different mothers. If that was so important to the state, if that was a credible explanation, they should have then asked Judge Bailey, and Bailey was willing to do it because Bailey explained to defense counsel that he thought it was important to know who the various mothers are, that the state should have asked Judge Bailey to ask all the veneer, they ask all the Caucasian jurors as well, if they had children of the same mother or father. And that was pointed out in Miller L. versus Drecke, that when the state fails to ask these supplemental questions, that's evidence of purposeful discrimination. So here we have a racially a hot case in that, you know, race was certainly a key to this case, with a black defendant accused of killing a white police officer. We have the state exercising 90% of their strikes against African Americans. We have identically situated Caucasian veneer people who are not excluded. We have the state failing to ask supplemental questions, which belies the fact that they were being credible in the explanations they gave to this court.
But let me ask you this. It is certainly the case at this point that there have been many opinions written, all to the effect that it's not the job of a federal court on collateral review to grade the writing style of a state court's decision. It's clear, looking at the transcript before Judge McSweeney Moore, that a great deal was ventilated in front of her by counsel on both sides. She writes what has got to be regarded at this point as a very unhelpful opinion, or she gives her reasons in a very unhelpful way. But nonetheless, we review bottom lines from the state courts. We don't review how they got there. And so even though there is this line of authority that you were talking about, that it's not the job of counsel later on to supply reasons that weren't given initially, how does that intersect with the deference that we give to the state courts and with the fact that, you know, this is a messy record? People might come to different conclusions. Shouldn't we give the benefit of the doubt to the state judge, as your opponent argues?
The judge gets, if this were a situation where the judge made factual findings, this court would give the trial judge, Judge McSweeney, more deference.
But don't you think there are implicit factual findings? We know the bottom line, at least. The bottom line is she thinks that there was not racial discrimination as prohibited by Batson in the selection of any members of this jury.
And
so working back from that, you know, don't we?
But and even more so, she did say, and she said it repeatedly, that she had considered the totality of the circumstances. And I mean, don't we assume that? Don't we have to assume that the judge is speaking honestly?
Your Honor, this court looks to the record, and where her statements are unsupported by the record, there's no presumption of correctness under 2254. That's one of the exceptions, that it's all, her conclusions are presumed correct only when they're supported by the record, and that did not occur in this case. The record, this court, as they said in Miller L., this court is as well positioned as she was to look at the record. Since no new evidence was adduced, no credibility determinations were made, there's no deference that needs to be accorded her determinations where they're unsupported by the record. And certainly her ultimate legal conclusion, this court can review de novo. I would submit that this case, as Your Honors have noted, has been going on for many years, and the errors have been multiplying, and the magnitude of the errors have been compounded.
Let me ask you something. I understand that, of course, Mr. Coulter was given a life sentence. Under the sentencing strictures in place at the time of his sentence, what would a life sentence equal out to? Do you know?
A life sentence is still natural life.
It would have been natural life,
yes,
at that time.
Yes. Your Honor, I believe, as Judge Conlon stated in June, that justice delayed is justice denied, that here Illinois has failed on every level, that each subsequent Coulter decision just is the Coulter 1 discredited by this court, Coulter 2 vacated by the U.S. Supreme Court, Coulter 3 relying on the vacated Coulter 2 decision, and everything Judge Conlon said, which requires that Duane Coulter be given a new trial. I would submit that this court, based on the record before it, grants Mr. Coulter a new trial and affirm Judge Conlon's finding of granting habeas relief.
Do you have anything else you wish to add?
The only comment I would add as far as Judge McSweeney Moore's comments about the judge's integrity, about the prosecutor's integrity, which were, I would submit, outside the record. They were unverifiable. And again, under 2254, when defendant doesn't have a fair or full opportunity to confront those findings, then again, those cannot be given any weight. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Salinger. Mr. Feinerman, we're going to give you your 3 minutes of rebuttal.
There were 16 African Americans on the veneer, 5 served, 3 on the 12-person jury, and 2 alternates. Prosecution wanted one more. We know that the prosecution wanted one more African American, William Moore, and his colloquy is at page 1178 to 1183. And there might have been another, Frank Perez, whom the prosecution wanted and Mr. Coulter struck. And on page 1225 of the transcript, defense counsel offered his view that Mr. Perez was African American. These statistics aren't dispositive, but taking them into account, along with the fact that the prosecution left 4 of its peremptories on the table, is very powerful evidence that racial discrimination was not taking place during the prosecution's peremptory strikes. Mr. Coulter argues that the presumption of correctness does not apply, but the Supreme Court held in Sumner, and we have Perkett and Mitchell and Palmer, state court findings based on a paper record are entitled to the same presumption of correctness as findings made by a court conducting an evidentiary hearing. That's black letter pre-AEDPA law.
You are arguing exactly, of course, what Judge McSweeney Moore did. She said that she, compared and contrasted the breakdown of the veneer with the jurors who were selected. I'm not confident that she was referring there to the state's treatment of similarly situated veneer members as opposed to the racial composition of the veneer versus the final jury. And that's a problem.
I think she did, and it's probably at page 102 of our supplemental appendix. She said, when you look at the actual breakdown of the jurors in the veneer, compare and contrast those to the ones that were selected, and based on my experience, she said that the alternates usually end up serving in a case like this. So she said she compared and contrasted.
Maybe she took such an analysis sub silentio as part of her totality of the circumstances review, but she didn't lay it out. She didn't lay out her analysis on the record.
That's correct. She did not lay out a juror-by-juror analysis on the record. That's correct, and she wasn't required to either by this court's opinion or by governing pre-AEDPA law. Finally, with respect to Pinkins, she was mentioned in Coulter 3, but I think we could take the procedural default finding in Coulter 2 is an alternative ground for rejecting the Pinkins claim. And when a forfeiture is offered as an alternative ground by the state court, that can provide an adequate and independent state ground. Thank you for the extra time, Judge Rovner.
Thank you very much. Well, thanks both to Mr. Feinerman and Ms. Salinger for, very fine briefs and a very fine argument. That's appreciated. And the case will be taken under advisement. And there will be a short recess while there is a change of judges.